Good day, South Dakota, and welcome to Tech Radio featuring the Computer Guys. I'm your host, Ken Osborne. On today's program, we'll discuss the latest in tech news. There's been a lot of news in the mobile market this week, from Samsung to Apple. We'll hit the highlights, plus your calls, texts, emails, and Facebook posts. We'd love to hear from you. Send your questions via email midday@sdpb.org or send a tweet to @sdpb. Join the discussion at facebook.com/techradio or call now, 800-524-3604. You can email your suggestions or questions to our guests today, Mac Guru Joel Brovelite. We'll have Amos Aesop, and from the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications and Peer, Jeff Litterick. That email address again, midday@sdpb.org. We'll hear from the panelists and you after this news from SDPB Radio. And welcome back to Tech Radio featuring the Computer Guys. We've gathered the experts to talk tech today and answer questions you might have. Joining us in the studios of KCSD in Sioux Falls, we have Mac Guru Joel Brovelite. Hey, Joel.
Hey.
It is great to have you back. Also, Amos Aesop is here.
Howdy.
How are you, Amos?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm great, actually. Nice, quiet, serene campus of USF. It's beautiful here.
Parking is easy today.
Parking is great today. Joining us a little later in the program is Jeff Litterick from the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications and Peer. We hope Jeff will fill us in on E3, which wrapped up yesterday. And, of course, we all know E3 is the big gaming confluence of peoples that talk about new games and gaming technology and all kinds of things. So we're hoping to catch up on that with Jeff a little bit later in the program. You can call, text, or tweet, or you can email your questions. Simply swing by facebook.com/techradio, post your comment or questions there. Don't be shy. Our phone number is 800-524-3604, 800-524-3604. The number, @SDPB is the Twitter handle, and of course our email address, midday@sdpb.org. The link I put out on the Facebook page today was an NPR story about a, they're calling it a bookless, basically a library without books. But I take exception to that almost. It's a makerspace down in Omaha. It's a building. It's got tech in it. They invested $7 million into this building. So you can come in and you've got access to computers that have software that businesses use, that artists use, of course, all the 3D printing technologies and all that kind of stuff too. But interesting story. Posted it out on the Facebook page. You can also find it, of course, at npr.org or from our app. The SDPB app, you can go in and find that there as well. But just a little jewel, if you'd like a little bit of reason to go to the Facebook page today, that interesting story. While you're there, jot a note for us. We like the comments there. We like questions on the Facebook page, so please do that. I think we're going to start out today. It was shocking news to me that Microsoft would buy LinkedIn for the whopping price of $26.2 billion, billion with a B. I didn't think LinkedIn was really worth that much.
You know, LinkedIn gets kind of a bad rap, doesn't it, about all the emails that it sends you and about what true value it really has. And but the value to Microsoft in this case is going to be, it's a lot like Facebook. The value is inherent in the data that it contains and the information about those people. And where I think this is going, and I've discussed this with a few other people, Microsoft makes a product for businesses, a CRM or a customer relationship management program based on the Dynamics platform. And where we think this is going to go is that within that piece of software, a customer relationship management program is where businesses keep all of the records about their customers. It's going to be, here's the company, here's the people who work for the company, here's the business we've done with them, here's the potential business we have. But if you had the ability as a salesperson to be able to go into your Dynamics platform and type in Kent Osborne and have it automatically populate the information about where you work today, where you've worked previously, the things that you've been affiliated with, the type of technologies and that sort of stuff, there's going to be a huge amount of information that those people will be able to gather. Now, I'm hoping right? That Microsoft is only going to be able to provide the information that you would normally be able to get through LinkedIn. Like today, if you're not, I don't know, friends or associated with somebody, you can only get a basic amount of information. But should you choose to connect with that person, then you have much more ability. I'm hoping they keep that in there as well. But from a sales perspective and from a marketing perspective, there's a lot of value in that data and being able to go in and say, you know, when I call Kent, what are the sorts of things that he's going to be interested in? What are the sorts of things that he's previously done? And where can I best position myself to sell him whatever it happens to be?
Oh, I like that, because then they have a little bit better understanding of what I actually do versus this cold call trying to sell me servers.
Right.
And they don't understand that I don't buy servers.
And you can get that information already today from places like Dun & Bradstreet and other services that provide that same information. But that's more of an overall company level, right? And so you can find out more about the company and who the CEO is and how long they've been around and what their valuations are. Now you're going to be able to take that a step further and find out about individuals. I'm assuming. I haven't read that anywhere. I don't know if that's where it's going, but yeah. It certainly seems to me like an easy jump to take the Microsoft platform and incorporate all of that data.
Well, the clue for me was they outbid Salesforce. So when I first heard this, I thought, well, they're just making a big ploy for big data. They just they're raking in all of this additional data that's going to go in the Microsoft vat. To in my mind, I'm thinking Google's got the big Alphabet's got the big vat, and there are other companies vying to have big vats of data, and this is just this is just going to get all that. But then I see the outbid Salesforce, and nobody knows how much Salesforce bid, but Microsoft was over $26 billion.
Well, in that arena, and that's interesting that you say that, because Salesforce is a direct competitor to the Microsoft Dynamics platform with CRM, and then there's also a third big player in there, which is Sugar CRM. And so that tells me that that's absolutely where they were going with it, because Salesforce would have a leg up on the other two competitors to say, if you purchase our platform, now you're going to have automatic access to all of the individuals, people who, you might be able to prospect to without having to pay those additional fees to services like Dun & Bradstreet.
Speaking of additional fees, is this at all mean that maybe Microsoft's going to peel away some of those layers of subscription layers, or that's how they make their money? They're going to leave them in there, do you think?
Subscription layers on?
Well, when I go into LinkedIn now, and I want to connect with somebody, it says, hey, how do you want to subscribe? Are you this kind of a subscriber? It lays out a menu of four different subscription levels that I can subscribe to if I want to get a hold of this person. And that's about when I stopped using LinkedIn.
Sure.
When they wanted money from me, I mean, I was willing to share with them my history and fill out my profile and do all that sort of stuff. And it was convenient. I could connect with people I knew, other people at other universities or other public broadcasting networks or wherever. I could connect with them. But now it seems like there's that paywall in between.
Well, there is some... There's obviously LinkedIn needs to be able to pay for their services somehow. They got to be able to pay for that infrastructure on the back end, the people who run it, the people who update it, the people who do the things that they do. But it's a lot like, there's certain industries that are willing to pay for that information. You get much more in-depth information, and you get much more robust information if you pay for it. A couple of things. One, if you're in sales, it's a good idea. Two, if you're a recruiter, it's a great idea, because then you can do searches for, show me all the people who are interested in, whatever technology it happens to be they're looking for to recruit. If you're in the market for a new job, it makes it a lot easier to market your abilities to people in LinkedIn. I know when I've been in the market for a job, I've actually chosen to do that pay-for service and gotten a lot of response from it. So, they have to make money too. In a lot of cases, it's not worth the typical user paying for it. But in other cases, if you've got a reason for it, and obviously you're going to be making money off of that, some people do pay for it. In fact, a lot of people pay for it.
Yeah. Do we know what I don't want to say install base, but the user base of LinkedIn is?
I don't know what that is.
I'll have to maybe look that up. But again, it just sort of, they fell off my radar when they started asking me for money a few years ago, and I haven't really done much to update my profile. And I did log in the other day just to kind of see what was in there and get a glance around a little bit. There was actually a person I was looking to contact off of a Twitter handle. And every phone number I found for this person dead-ended. And so I went to LinkedIn and I found the person. And it was it ended up being a good experience for me, but I hadn't been in there in a while, so this news was kind
of
interesting to me.
First quarter of 2016, 433 million people have a profile in there. Now, of course, it's a lot like Facebook, right? I mean, some people go in there and just like you sign up because it's the new system. What is this? I'm going to fill it out, and maybe some of those things have been abandoned. Maybe some of them are stale and old and don't have updated information, but some people do keep it up to date.
Sure. Well, a reminder to folks, you can call, text, tweet, or email your questions today. We have a couple of emails coming in. I appreciate that. Facebook.com/TechRadio, and you can post your question or comment there. Or don't be shy, our phone number, 800-524-3604. Of course, the email address, midday@sdpb.org. And I'm going to save the wireless IP security camera question for Jeff later. But Kathleen asks, and this is an interesting question because I don't know if we've all seen the signs that are going up in the Black Hills that say, if your GPS says that you're on your way to Mount Rushmore, you're really not. Have you seen those?
I haven't.
Oh, this is it was kind of a funny thing that went around Facebook a couple of weeks ago. But it's not so funny for the residents out there. And Kathleen writes, I live in eastern Pennington County, south of the Badlands National Park. My neighbors and I live on gravel roads off of Highway 44 east of Scenic. We are becoming disturbed by the number of tourists who come up our little private road seeking the entrance for Badlands National Park, sometimes getting stuck and needing to be rescued. Almost without fail, this is where my GPS says to go. And I have taken to stocking a pile of paper maps and setting them free with the maps. So her question is, who programs these GPS systems, or who makes the maps that go into the GPSs?
Well, that's really two different questions. Really, what's most important is who controls what is put onto the GPS, because who makes it might not be relevant at all, because they wouldn't have any control about how it gets released to the general public via, Google Maps or Apple Maps or Garmin or whatever it is that that person's using. So to be honest with you,
yes,
I would recommend that the person, if they're looking to, kind of get it fixed, I would recommend going directly to the people who release it, whether that's Google or Apple or probably not Garmin, but maybe Garmin. And I would notify them. And I don't know this for sure, but I'm certain there is a way to notify somebody there of errors in mapping. And I'm sure if you Google that, you'll be able to find out where to go. But you're not going to find out who makes the maps and who controls it and all that stuff, because they probably subcontract that to several different people, and the data is probably lifted from here or there, and they pay so much whatever, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. So that is probably pointless. But going to where the GPS is coming from, Apple, Google, that type of thing, mm-hmm. that's probably where I'd go.
And there are links in there to submit corrections, because Google is well aware that some of those things are incorrect, and some of that stuff is automated, right? I mean, when you go in and you go into Google and you type in "take me from Sioux Falls to Mount Rushmore," that system is going to look at all of the available data, and it's going to, in its best guess, tell you how to get there. Some roads change, some roads get bigger, some roads go away, some facilities are built that might get in the way. But usually those services are going to provide a link. Is this not correct? And you can change that. There's been humorous stories of people
who
follow their GPS blindly and end up literally driving into a body of water.
Into a lake. Yep.
Well, that's where GPS told me to go. And you got to kind of consider what the person, what were you thinking? But at the same time, there are mistakes that are out there, and Google has done a great job of trying to, map every possible road and even get down to the street level, you know, where they take the Google car and drive down and take the street level photos. They simply can't do everything. And so,
and to be fair, this was a mistake in map making going back hundreds of years.
Right.
I can tell you several times when I've followed actual maps where the map is, you know, not correct or simply doesn't show something that's clearly there, depending on where you got it. So just because it's a computer doesn't mean it's more or less accurate than a map. In fact, I'd venture a guess that most of the digital maps with both Google and Apple are probably more accurate than the large percentage of actual maps that are out there.
Yeah, true. And think, I mean, there's a few things that are wrong, but think of all the things that are right, too.
Right.
I mean,
which is most things.
The minutia, and of course, it's not minutia to the person who has to deal with it, right?
No.
I mean, it's
of course,
a pain.
Yeah, that doesn't make it, yeah, not a problem.
It doesn't make it a problem, not a problem, but that's interesting. He showed me the sign there, and it looks like they put some effort into that. That's a professionally made sign.
Yeah, the Dakotas Conference of the United Methodist Church placed a sign warning travelers that the GPS is sending them to the wrong place. It's just big old sign. I'll put a link on the Facebook page. It says, "Your GPS is wrong. This is not Mount Rushmore. Go back to Highway 16 and take a right and follow the signs to Keystone."
Seems like that maybe could have been better spent by getting a hold of somebody to get that GPS fixed.
I was thinking the same thing.
Not near as funny.
Yeah, it is. That is pretty funny.
Well, that's what she writes in her email to us today. She says, you know, on a humorous note, and she says, well, maybe it's not really humorous. Think of what it's going to look like out here when all the Google driverless cars start stacking up on the dead end roads out by Badlands.
You know, that's a good point. I didn't think about that, because those that do the driverless vehicles are going to follow those blindly and don't have that.
They are, but they will also recognize, hey, I'm on gravel, not cement. So clearly a problem here. The data and the compiling is going to be even better.
I'm in water, not on I-90.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. Or there's water, you know, 200 feet ahead. Maybe I best not go into that. I would venture a guess that the automated cars are going to be responsible for fewer people driving into lakes than actual people.
There's actually a knowledge base article, Google Maps Help, report an error. Go to Google Maps. There's a menu and a send feedback and report a data problem.
And I assume the more reports they get on a single problem,
right,
the higher up it goes.
The
That's usually
data.
How that goes. Yeah. So if you've got a true problem in your area like this, I recommend, you know, you submit it several times and have several people submit it several times, that will take care of it.
That whole church congregation submit it, you know.
I would be surprised if that's on the web at all. I would be surprised if that's not fixed, you know,
right,
shortly.
Well, it was reported in the Rapid City Journal, so it's on the web. So here's my brush with churches and data problems. Last week, I get a call from the pastor of the Dalesburg Lutheran Church, which is just north of Vermilion. And he says, you know, I put my thing into your online calendar, and it's showing people that the church is in the wrong place. What do I do? Mm. And of course, it's pulling the Google Maps, and I go to the entry, and I go to the address, and sure enough, it's got the pin stuck out in the middle of a, you know, out in the middle of a field somewhere that's nowhere even close to where the church is. So there is a reporting tool.
Mm-hmm.
And I grab onto the little pin, and I try to place it exactly where it is, and I fat finger it and screw it up and send it off, and there's no take this back kind of a thing. So I hope there's a human being on the other end vetting this stuff, because I tried to fix it and screwed it up.
I'm sure what happens is they aren't going to just take every fix that one individual sends them. They're going to aggregate those with other requests. And, you know, the more requests, it'll probably get looked at by a person if it seems like it's important or dangerous.
And there's some terrible examples of that, actually, in that, like through Google Plus and that sort of stuff, you can submit changes to locations or businesses and maybe update, you know, give them new information on what type of business that is. One of which was recently done was on the Pulse nightclub after the shooting happened. There were people who went in and started changing that sort of thing to very vulgar things. And so, yes, there has to be a human on the other end to make sure that sort of information, the trolls of the internet, aren't able to go out there and make things completely
incorrect. This hasn't been a real great week for sanity on social media.
Right.
Maybe we'll talk about that. We have to take a quick break, and we'll get Jeff Litterick on the line and move on with the show after this quick break. And welcome back to Tech Radio, featuring the Computer Guys here on member-supported SDPB Radio. We're talking tech today. We're at the studios of KCSD in Sioux Falls, and we have Mac guru Joel Brovelite is here with a ton of Mac news coming up a little bit later on in the program. We have Amos Ace up here, and on the line with us, Jeff Litterick now. Just before the break, we were commenting this. For me, socially this week, following Twitter feeds, following Facebook feeds, it hasn't been a real enjoyable experience for me. It seems like there's been a lot of tragedy. We have people falling off paths in, you know, Yellowstone. There was some buffalo issues, and of course, they have alligator problems, and with Orlando, the really tragic shooting there, and all the coverage. It seems like these really horrible, horrific things bring out the best in people, and in another aspect bring out the worst in people.
It does. The anonymity of the internet, and we've been seeing this forever, right? If you go into YouTube and you look at any comment of any personal video, you're going to see some of the worst internet there is. And we hope that that's significantly outnumbered by the good things. But through that anonymity, people are able to be absolutely terrible to one another, and it shows up in social media, and it shows up quickly. And that's one of the pros of that social media, is being able to get information disseminated very quickly, but at the same time, you can get either misinformation or information that is just disheartening to see.
Well, that's the other half of this, is you see these memes come out, and they're cherry-picking facts. Mm-hmm. And not telling whole stories and
to making be fair, comparisons. Of course, it's not like that's new, where people have cherry-picked facts.
No,
it's
not new at all.
By quite a bit. My take on that is, obviously, that's all true, everything that you said. The real deal, I think, though, is the internet just gets us that information faster. Those people with, you know, that were standing in line, you know, giving blood in Orlando, those people were around before the internet. We just found out about that. We may not have ever found out about that if it wasn't for the speed of information. And of course, all the bad stuff we find out about a lot faster. But those people with terrible opinions and horrible things to say, and those people with great things to say, that we just get that information faster. But nothing in human nature has changed at all.
There's a couple things that concern me. One is the volume, the sheer volume of things that friends that I know just automatically repost. If their opinion happens to any way coincide with this horrible piece of whatever they're trying to forward, they just go ahead and forward it. And when I point out to them that it's a complete falsehood, they don't care, because it supports their agenda or their beliefs or their whatever. They don't care if it's completely wrong and misleading, they're just going to forward it on anyway. And that, to me, is really bad.
Well, what should make you feel better? Go ahead. Yeah.
But here's where I'm getting to is, so the BBC reported this week there's a big YouGov survey that went out to 50,000 people across like 26 countries, and these are kids, 18 to 24. I'm going to use the word kids, but they're adults, but they're young adults. 28% cited social media as their main source of news. Okay, and of those, 24% was television. So social media has taken over, which is, I don't think it surprised anybody in this program, but social media has taken over the main source of news for young people. 44% of those, it was Facebook, 19 YouTube, interestingly enough, and 10% Twitter. And I thought those facts would have been flipped. I thought maybe Twitter would be number one, or at least number two behind Facebook.
Well, I don't know about that. The problem with Twitter is also its advantage in that what you can get on Twitter is very fast and very immediately relevant, but not very deep because of the character limit and just because of the nature of the platform itself. What I was going to say before I interrupted you,
yeah,
and which was great because what you said is exactly what I was going to say, but kind of in a different light. Young people, just like you said, the difference between them and a lot of people our age and older and maybe slightly younger is they can see that information for what it is, and they can parse that information in a way better the way than we do. And certainly people I know that are older than me, when they see something on the internet, they take it like it was on the newspaper, like it must be true because somebody typed it out. But nobody under 18 thinks that that's even remotely true, because they know that they can do that. They know they can create a YouTube channel and talk about anything that they want. They know that they can send a tweet out that means and says anything. So they immediately, for the most part, meet anything like that with skepticism. And they're also smart enough to check multiple sources, even though it might be on the same platform. And they can aggregate that in a way that kind of boggles the mind of anybody that grew up in the newspaper age. And I think that's all there is to it. So it seems like it's scary that they're getting their information from YouTube or Twitter. I tell you what, if something happens locally, if I see an accident on 41st Street, one of the first places I go is Twitter. I mean, where else would I go if I want to find something out that happened 4 minutes ago? Mm-hmm. That's what I do, because I know I can get it that way. So even though it sounds really terrible, that's one of my main sources of news. But I hopefully try to aspire as well as some of these young people do it. But I aggregate that data too. I mean, if I see one person that posts one thing, I don't automatically believe that that's true. I will find another source. Or if there are 10 tweets that say the exact same thing, well, then maybe there's something to that. But if I see one and then I see 10 that say the opposite, well, I'm going to have to dig in, or I'm going to have to be skeptical. I know that that's what my daughter does. I just expect that that's what young people are going to do, because they're used to it. They grow up in this.
Is there a danger to that?
Well, I think there's a danger to any media platform. You know, how dangerous is it when something gets misprinted in the newspaper and you don't find out until the next day or maybe a week later that there's an error? But who finds out about that? At least with the internet, it can be checked and verified by multiple sources. I'm not saying that that's bad or that's good, but I think it has its own balance and counterbalance. And thinking that kids should get their information, or young people should get their information, the way we did, is beyond ridiculous. It's not going to happen, no matter how much you wish it to be.
Yeah, I guess I'm glad I don't. I'm not ridiculous, but. What I was just thinking was, you know, it seems like some people have walled themselves into these little echo chambers, and the only viewpoint that they tolerate are ones that are similar to theirs.
Yeah.
And that really...
That is dangerous. That is dangerous. I don't know that that's any different than somebody that maybe 50 years ago didn't read anything or didn't know anything about the news and had no information whatsoever. You know, I remember hearing stories about people that had gone their whole life and not voted for president because they didn't know when the elections were or who was running. I'm not sure that would happen today. So I think it's just a different type of uninformed person. I don't know that that means there are more uninformed people.
Okay. Well, let's get to this other, we've got another question here on the email, midday@stpv.org. Jim from Sioux Falls has a wireless IP security camera at his house. He would like to access the camera while he's away from his home Wi-Fi network. So he tried doing this using a program called noip.com, and I'm not familiar with the noip folks. For some reason, he cannot get the camera to work when he's away. So port forwarding is required with the router to go to that noip.com to work properly. He says, do you know anything about port forwarding and wireless IP cameras? And I know enough to be dangerous. I can follow the Samsung directions on my home security system and sort of work my way through it. But I'm wondering if Jeff Litterick, I believe he's on the line now. Jeff, do you have any suggestions for getting the port forwarding to work with an external website? And let's, if we can back this up a little bit, why is it necessary to use another company for this IP work? Is that for the DNS, sort of the routing of the data?
Well, somewhat, yes, but you don't necessarily need to have that third party. I'll kind of go through the step-by-step process.
Okay.
To gain access to that camera, because your router is actually a firewall, you're going to have to forward traffic from the outside, i.e. the internet, through your firewall to your camera so that when you make that connection, it flows through. And to do that, there's two things you need to do. First of all, you need to know the IP address of the outside of your firewall slash router, which can change whenever, you know, you reboot or your ISP decides to change it. And I'll get into how you can tell that here in a bit. The second part is you're going to have to configure the firewall slash router to do port forwarding or a DMZ, sometimes they're called DMZs on these routers, to your wireless camera. And for that, you need to know the internal IP address of the camera. So what you're going to do on the router is you have to know the IP address of the wireless camera, and you got to make sure it doesn't change often. If you can, and go into your router and static that up in your DHCP, I would highly suggest you do that so it doesn't change. Then you're going to have to go into your firewall slash port forwarding part of your router and forward all incoming traffic from the internet to that internal IP address of your wireless camera. That gets you through the firewall. And if there's configuration instructions and just what ports you need, I highly recommend you do not forward all ports, but just the ports you need. But for testing, I would first start by forwarding all ports, i.e. DMZ type thing, just to make sure it's working, and then lock it down. The second part, which is a little bit trickier, is that you need to always know what the outside IP address of your router firewall is, which can change depending on your ISP at any time. What I usually recommend you for this is called dynamic DNS. And what you have to do is you actually have to have a router that supports this. And what you'll do is you'll actually sign up for a dynamic DNS. There's a few different providers. They're all about the same. I've used a couple in the past. You actually tell your router that you are going to use dynamic DNS and point it to the provider you wish to have. Like I said, your router has to support this. Many do, especially the higher-end ones. If yours does not, you're going to have to find one that does. Because what happens is every time your IP address changes in the router is going to have to notify your dynamic DNS provider that the IP address changed and here's what the new IP address is. Once you make that connection, then your dynamic DNS provider will give you an actual DNS name that will always point to your ever-changing IP address on your firewall so that you can connect. To actually connect, you don't need to have the dynamic DNS. It just helps for long-term as your IP address changes. For testing, you don't need it at all. All you need to know is the outside IP address that's on your router at that point in time, and you can test just using the IP address without a name. That test your port forwarding, then work on the dynamic DNS so that in the future when your IP address changes, you don't have to keep looking up your IP addresses.
Will local internet providers, DSL or cable providers, will they give you a static IP?
Will
they sell you one? Okay.
And it's a little bit harder now unless you want to go to a business class service, which means you're going to be paying a lot more than what you're paying today.
Okay. All right.
Just because there are no more IPv4 addresses being given out in North America. So everyone's getting really tight on those. And dynamic lets them reuse them much more efficiently. So you can, but you're going to have to be willing to pay for it.
Okay.
Yeah,
Joel?
I was going to have two suggestions. First off, that you can get it if you're willing to pay for it. If it's important enough, you can get a static IP, and that's probably how that webcam or that IP webcam was really meant to be used, with a static IP.
Sure.
But what I would really recommend is go out and get a camera like Dropcam that has its own method for getting through that. And they're just more reliable. They're now getting down to the $100 range for 1080p resolution. I know I use the Nest Dropcam. I have a couple of those. They work flawlessly. They always do what you want it to do. It's kind of a pain because if you want to record the data, you have to pay them. But there are other services out there that you don't have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you just want to watch what's live, that doesn't cost you anything other than buying the camera. That's an app that I've used. So I would just recommend getting a new camera for as little as they cost and as easy as they are to set up. I think that's going to be a lot less headache. Although what Jeff told you is 100% right. That will work if you're willing to do all that work and make sure you have the right router. But as soon as you start having to buy new hardware, bam, just get a new camera. It's going to be cheaper.
Yeah. Or this solution would work well if you had a lot of cameras. Like my home security system has multiple cameras.
Sure.
You can tie that one DVR in with the internet and be able to see that. We do need to take a quick break. I realize that we have a lot of Apple stuff to talk about, and we're going to hit that next right after this. And we're back to the third and final segment of Tech Radio for this June, warm, sultry June day. Thank you for joining us. The way to get a hold of us, 800-524-3604 or facebook.com/techradio. If we haven't beat that into your skull enough today, there's a couple of really good reasons to go out there. You can see that funny sign we talked about earlier that's not so funny for local residents, and also that interesting article out of Omaha on the bookless library that I really think is just a makerspace, but it's got a catchy headline. Go ahead, Jeff.
I'd like to interject, and Joel kind of mentioned this, with the cloud-based security stuff and the cameras, there is one benefit that you can never have over your local system, and that is automatic alerts going out, especially if your internet gets cut or anything like that, automatic alerts that something's going wrong with your system or that it's detected motion or sound. So those do have some benefits over the ones that you can just come in remotely and view to.
Is the Internet of Things going to need to make this process a whole lot easier? Or is it going to be needed when we start connecting, you know, toasters and refrigerators and Alexas?
I think for the most part, you know, just like I mentioned with the Drop Cam or the Nest Cam, I guess it's called, or any other number of new devices out there, they just bypass that. They set it up for you, which is really the way it should be. You know, if you set up a Nest Cam, you don't have to find out what the IP address. You don't have to do anything. You plug it in, answer some questions, put your email in, register, and it works. Which is definitely going to be the way everything is going to be, because nobody wants to monkey around with that. Not even me.
Thank goodness. Now, is that what's behind in the new iOS updates that are coming out from Apple? There's a new app in there called Home.
Yeah, Apple has had this section of their home automation developer suite called HomeKit, which allowed developers such as Nest or Philips or whoever. Eve, to create products that work with Apple's devices, but also, and most importantly, fit within their security constraints.
Okay.
So to keep your house secure as far as not being able to be hacked and not releasing information that you don't want released and keeping it local on your device, that's kind of the big sticking point for a lot of home automation working with Apple. But so HomeKit's actually been around for nearly 2 years now. But now they're integrating it into the Apple TV and all of the mobile devices, including the iPad, rather than it having to run on a home computer or a router of some sort. It will now be, you'll be able to control all of your devices and set them all up from your Apple TV or your tablet, which sounds like, well, duh, you could probably do that before. But the important function of that is you can remotely control your house. You can unlock the door without having to have a separate device. You know, even as soon as 6 months ago, if you wanted to control several different types of devices, you had to have a hub for this device, and then that had to be hooked up to your router, and then you had to access that. This bypasses that, allowing your whether it's your tablet or your computer or your Apple TV to essentially be the hub for devices like light bulbs and door locks and other home automation devices, allowing developers to just create the product and work with the software and not have to come up with all these little things that you have to plug in and hook up to your Wi-Fi. So it's kind of making it easier. So a lot of this is under the hood and it's probably going over the head of lots of people out there. But the important part is just more of making it easy to plug something in and work and do what you want it to. Be able to just raise your phone and say, turn on the living room lights, and it will do that.
So this is kind of removing a layer of complexity or technology from the whole system. Is that what Homebridge is?
Homebridge is not anything to do with Apple. I think
Yep.
Nope. Homebridge is actually something Samsung has.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, they announced that you're going to be able to use Siri to turn things on and off through Homebridge.
Yeah.
So, okay.
The HomeKit. Yeah, I'm not. Homebridge is HomeKit, and using the app Home app. But actually, you've been able to turn things on and off with Siri already.
Okay.
But what you can do now is you'll be able to use Siri to turn off your light bulbs while you're, say, at the restaurant, without having to have a third party hub or a second party hub, as it were. You'll be able to do that from whatever Apple device or whatever device you have, without having to have all this extra layer, as you say, of technology to enable that.
I think I'm following along now. There was a lot of other innovations, I guess, announced this week.
Yeah, probably the overarching thing. Yeah. They had a every year Apple has a WWDC, which is called Worldwide Developer Conference, in which they get all of the people that write software for all the different Apple platforms together, and they often release new products at these things, and the developers get together and exchange ideas with Apple and say, hey, we like this, we don't like this, whatever. That's what WWDC is. This year, they didn't release any hardware, which I think bums out, 80% of the people that even care about the Apple news at all. But what they did do, and they've never done, is announced and released at least a beta version of every one of their new operating systems. And it might be news to people to know that they actually have four operating systems. They don't just have one or two. They have the macOS, which is what runs on the desktop. Incidentally, they changed it from macOS 10. Now it's just called macOS, which doesn't seem like a big thing to anyone else. They changed the name so they don't have to drag along that macOS 10 thing. You won't see X's on anything anymore.
Okay.
So they released a new version of the macOS, which will be out for most of the users out in the fall, but the beta's out now. A new version of the mobile operating system for iPads and iPhones that will also be out in the fall. There's a beta version starting next month for the public if they want to sign up for it. They released a new version of the Watch OS, again, a beta next month and coming out sometime for free in the fall. Probably most interesting, at least to me, a new version of the Apple TV operating system, tvOS. Again, beta next month, release for free in the fall. All of these are free release for the users. So they've never done it where they've released new versions of the operating system for everything all at once. Predictably, a lot of what's happening in all of these operating systems, interaction between all of these operating systems is going to get tighter. For instance, you'll be able to copy something on your desktop and then paste it on your tablet. So you won't have to send a file over or anything. You'll just be able to click paste from your tablet, and you'll get that picture that you copied from the web on your iPad, and so on and so forth. A lot of really neat features. Probably the biggest changes are coming to the mobile operating system, iOS. And we can talk about those, but I know we're going to run out of time. We can probably hit those later as it gets released, maybe the beta. But you can read all that online. But lots of great features and all new OSs, and they're all going to be free for all of your Apple devices. So really neat stuff coming up.
I guess the thing I read most of the reviews on there's 15 things that most people are highlighting on this.
Right.
And the takeaway for me was, the updates to photo or the photo program, the photo sharing and everything, is a lot of that was what they announced apparently last year with Picasa and Google.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks very similar with the exception of the security part of it and the privacy part of it that Apple brings to it.
Yeah, and that's something I think Apple's leaning heavier and heavier on. And it just kind of came out of nowhere, frankly, that Apple is now being known as the most security conscious operating system slash Big Brother out there. And they really leaned in on that this conference, and they talked about how they have a new algorithm that changes the not changes that globalizes the way that they collect data and then distribute it. So, for instance, if a developer wants to find out how many people are using, you know, listening to, say, a new Kanye West song, what this globalization of this software does that they've been using and now is over all the products, it allows them to access that data and distribute it, yet not be able to pick out which user did what for what piece of information. And that's been kind of a constraint on developers, like I said, with a lot of the home automation stuff. Some people don't want to use that level of security because it requires hardware and it requires deeper software written, so they don't necessarily work with HomeKit. But the advantage for us users is all of that data is stored locally for us. So if I surf to the IRS.gov website, nobody but me knows that I did that. However, Apple can then say to the government, if they asked, well, we had 14,000 users that accessed that website during these 24-hour periods in Sioux Falls, but they can't pin that directly to a user. That gets really complicated and heady, but that is now going to be built in globally to all of it and be available to developers, meaning they can incorporate that level of security into their software, which is even better for us users.
Is that that differential policy?
That's
that
exactly what it is. Okay. The differential policy.
It's a complicated word for that. Hey Jeff, I'm sorry to tell you that we're going to kind of shortchange you on the E3 updates, but is there a couple of nuggets you can throw out? E3, the big gaming conference, just wrapped up yesterday. There was some hardware news. There was some other Final Fantasy news for those the followers of that Dynasty gaming system. Do you have a couple of nuggets you can share with us today from E3?
Yeah, some vaporware has proven to be real and be released here in later this year for The Last Guardian for Sony system, and also the new console stuff. The main news being the new Xbox One that's for 4K gaming. And do take Microsoft's word, if you don't have a 4K TV, do not buy it. It's designed for people with 4K TVs. It's the same Xbox. It's just going to play games in 4K resolution. So unless you have that higher resolution monitor TV, it's kind of a waste. But it is a smaller version, too. Takes up less space. They're thinking that's going to be a big hit. And also, a lot of cross between Windows 10 and Xbox One, where games will work on both. You will buy a game on for one, and you'll be able to play on both. That's a big Microsoft thing, and a lot of the games announced will be what they call Play Anywhere, meaning you can play on your Windows 10 PC or your Xbox for one price when you first buy the game for either platform. So.
Oh, wow, that is big news. That is big news. I downloaded my first MOBA. And I didn't realize that there were mobile online battle arenas, and started getting into that a little bit. Again, spawned from an NPR story this week about a gentleman that got into professional gaming, I guess is what you want to call
it.
It's
a thing now.
After having suffered a debilitating injury, he got into gaming, and now that's his livelihood. So, again, more information out there at NPR.org if you want to follow into that. But I'll have to update you on that in a couple of weeks. Jeff, as we hear the music, our next show, July 1st, we'll have some local news. There's another local conference again for folks to get together with the database folks, and we'll have a special guest in the studio in July to talk about that event in Sioux Falls coming up, of course, in the month of July. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's program. I want to thank my panelists today and remind you SDPB is always there for you with our app or at sdpb.org. Go there, click on listen. Have a great weekend, everybody.